When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Good Food Podcast. It's me, Tom Kerridge. In this episode, I chatted with Melissa Thompson about dusting off the barbecue, including her favourite thing to cook over fire.
Kind of be any cabbage, like people talk about, like sweetheart cabbage or hispy cabbage, but you want to cut it through the root so it kind of stays together. It will just make life easier when it comes to doing it.
Yeah.
I rinse it and then I don't shake all the water off so that the steam in between the layers kind of helps it cook like from inside. And then I'll make some sort of butter, like a flavoured butter, and I will brush it as it's cooking. And then the edges get like brown and crispy.
Plus, her recent adventure into dehydrating. Okay, so I'm joined right now by the amazing, incredible Melissa Thompson, and wealth of knowledge. How are you, mate?
I'm really good. How are you?
We're doing all right. But listen, what exciting things? I know we mentioned briefly before we just started recording that you were doing something mega and exciting. Like I'm watching what you do on social media, and you're into dehydrating right now.
Yeah.
Is that the way forward? Is that the way forward with everything?
I think it is for me. Do you know what, right? If I could just dehydrate stuff for the rest of my life and make combinations of different powders, I'd be happy. It started, I made a Christmas wreath and it was awful. So I thought I'd dehydrate some orange slices. I've got this like kind of slow cooker, pressure cooker thing in one, and it's got a dehydrate function that I'd never used.
Yeah.
And so I made these slices of orange to see if I could rescue my wreath, and it worked. And then I had some Scotch bonnet chilies, and I was like, I wonder if I can make some Scotch bonnet powder, because you don't really see that, right?
Yeah.
And obviously I use Scotch bonnets a lot. And
so super spicy chilies.
Yeah, but really fruity and they've got such a unique flavour and like a real kind of stalwart of like Jamaican cooking.
Yeah.
And I know it sounds silly, but it's these things like paprika that, especially I think in this country, because I've had lots of other people saying the same, like I didn't realise paprika was just made from dried peppers.
Yeah.
And so I made this Scotch bonnet pepper, and then I just started dehydrating everything. And I've done cheese, I've done pickled onions the other day, and it's so much fun.
What's the flavour profile then of the pickled onions? What does it come out like?
Monster Munch.
The best Monster Munch flavour around is pickled onion flavour.
Absolutely.
I absolutely love it. So the process is there's a bit of kit that's on a really low temperature, takes moisture out of the air, and makes everything just dehydrate, dry, crispy.
Yes.
And then what do you do with it? You blend it into a powder.
Yeah, so it's a different things work in different ways. So if it's a vegetable like peppers, then you can do it entirely in the dehydrator. And then I'll take it out, and some things might have a tiny little bit of bend. So I just leave it in kind of ambient temperature for what, like an hour, and then it will completely dry out. And then I'll blitz it up. Cheese, I've done feta, which is really exciting. I've done blue cheese as well.
Dehydrated cheese.
Yes, which is interesting.
That sounds mental.
It's really good. And I think, because a lot of things, the flavour intensifies when you take out all the moisture. But then with cheese, it doesn't blow your head off. It's kind of like the feta is actually quite, almost like if you ever had like fior de latte, like ice cream, it has that gentle milkiness about it.
Yeah.
And that's almost like you get a bit of that with the feta. And so with the feta, you slice it, you kind of dry it as much as you can with kitchen towel, put it in there, and then the oil starts to rise as you're dehydrating it. So you have to wipe the oil off and then dehydrate it for longer than you would vegetables. And then again, leave it like just in the air for maybe, out of the dehydrator in the air for maybe a day. And then it goes rock solid and then you blitz it up. And the feta is like, it's completely shelf stable. I don't need to keep it in the fridge. It doesn't need anything else. And it's just, I've actually got some.
And that's when it continues to dry up.
Yeah.
But I imagine the feta, and the feta is super salty. It's got that flavour profile that's, you know, it's got a slight acidity to it. But the main kick fruit that comes from feta is that saltiness.
Yes.
And is that, does that then really intensify as you dry it?
Yes. Yeah, totally. So I made the mistake. I cooked one thing with it as a spice rub. And I put the feta and I added salt, and then it was too salty. So now I use the feta powder in lieu of salt. So no extra salt and just the feta powder.
I mean, this sounds like an amazing kind of project to be getting on with. But what other things have you got going on in your life right now? What stuff are you working on, apart from things that are drying out in somewhere in a kitchen?
So I guess getting ready for summer, even though it feels quite early. But I do a lot of, well, as you know, like a lot of fire cooking, a lot of barbecue stuff. So kind of making plans for the summer, different festivals and things like that. And then I'm a co-director of the British Library's food season, which starts in May. So we're kind of finalising events for that. And that's quite exciting, kind of like loads of different discussions and things. And I've got a few other kind of, you know, what do we call it? In the fire, like tongs in the fire.
Irons in the fire.
A few other little projects.
A little bit of mover, a little bit of a shaker, things going on in the food world. I mean, you mentioned it there. You've got, you talked about the weather getting a bit better. Barbecue. Now, you're known for Caribbean-influenced cookery, for barbecue, outdoor food, the kind of the flavour profile and driving things that are really quite interesting. So what sort of things are we looking forward to? We got a couple of spring bank holidays coming up. The weather is changing. What sort of things should we be looking at? And what are you enjoying barbecuing at the minute?
So, I kind of barbecue all year round. And I think, especially now in the spring.
So you do it in the winter as well? Oh, absolutely. You're just constantly outside doing it?
Yeah. Amazing. Well, because also, I mean, I'm quite a sociable person, but at the same time, sometimes, especially if there's lots of people and it's really intense, you've got like loads of kids running around screaming and things. If I'm barbecuing, I can extract myself from that situation and go and hide in the garden.
Yeah.
And just, oh, no, I can't, I'm busy. Do you know what I mean? And I can go and hide for like 20 minutes. And so, and also, for me, the worst time to barbecue is the height of summer, because no one needs to be standing around a raging fire when it's like 28 degrees outside.
So do you do a lot of slow cooks on a barbecue more in the winter than you do in the summer? Or do you do that kind of profile and that flavour profile of like slow and low barbecue outdoor cookery all year round?
That's interesting, actually. No, I absolutely do more low and slow. Like summer's kind of about quick grilling. And I hadn't thought about that, kind of the seasonality of almost like what, like how you cook and what you cook. So I do a lot of kind of stews over, like, you know, like oxtail stew, things like that. And I've done hot pot. And, you know, a lot of people say, but like, what's the point of doing that over fire when you can just do it in the oven? But then I try to break it down as much as possible. So I made oxtail the other day.
Yeah.
And then I just seasoned it with salt to start off, put it directly over the fire, get that real nice browning going on.
So is this when you're cooking on a barbecue now, is this one of those egg style ones that are sealed, or is this actual just on coals outdoors giving off
heat?
It's
a kettle. Yeah, right, kettle barbecue. Okay.
Yeah.
So with a lid. So but kind of utilising all of it. So sometimes just grilling over direct heat, and then I'll put all the oxtail seasoning on and get it back over the fire. And then I might roast the onions in their skins, like on the coal, so you get that lovely sweetness, right?
Yeah,
and
that gorgeous caramelization that happens from onions on a barbecue like that. They're just so nice, aren't they?
Yes, it's unbeatable.
Yeah,
unbeatable.
That driver flavor. We always use onions, no matter what we do in terms of cookery, and whether it's classic French style or whether it's, you know, modern British cuisine and European standard, you know, onions are the base level of so many dishes, whether it's stews, casseroles, risottos, or anything like that. But actually then, if you can get a flavour profile that's next level, like roasted on the coals with the skin on, and then take them off, you can't change that flavour profile, and it stays there for the dish forever, doesn't
it? Totally. And it really changes it. And also, because there are some dishes, I think, where I don't know, like a kind of a ragu, and if people add onions, I add onions to a ragu. And my mum always added a bit of sugar with, kind of to counter the acidity of the tomatoes. But I think if you cook your onions long enough and draw out that sweetness, you don't need to, because it just really rounds it out, and it's delicious.
It's having the patience, so that's the thing, isn't it? It's enjoying the process. That's it. You've got to give yourself time to get on and do it. But what's your favourite sort of things to then cook on a barbecue? As we're moving to spring, what are you going to be rocking out with? Because spring, we talk about, you know, one of the main dishes that come out in spring is lamb. And I'm a big fan of lamb. So something like a spiced leg of lamb that I would do with some harissa or something like that would be perfect for springtime moving through into summer. Because you could either cook it quite quickly and just keep it nice and pink, but you could also use that leg and braise it as well. So it's kind of that lovely crossover.
Yes.
Well, what would you do?
So I'm a big fan of lamb, and we're, you know, sort of wild garlic season at the moment, and I've got a little patch of wild garlic in my garden.
No way.
Yeah.
Where do you live?
In Southeast London.
Southeast London, yeah. You've got wild garlic growing there.
Yeah, I transplanted a tiny little bit into my garden. Okay, and so over the years, it's grown and grown and grown.
Wow.
And so now I've got, it's kind of enough to keep me going.
Patch.
Yeah, it's lovely. And at first as well, it was to just give me a signal to let me know when wild garlic was up. And so I could go into my local spot to go and pick some.
Oh yeah, your secret foraging spot, you're never going to give up
exactly,
where that is. Yeah,
exactly. Or on pain of death.
Yeah. Yeah, and £30 a kilo somewhere else. Yeah, I don't blame you.
Yes, but then and like lamb. So I mean, recently sort of a butterflied leg of lamb. Well, I didn't butterfly it. I got the butcher to do it because I tried to do it once. I made a mess of it. And so I stuff it with like wild garlic and parsley and some lemon zest and then regular garlic and some pine nuts. And then I kind of cook that over the barbecue, kind of just quite low, and then kind of turn the heat up and just get it nice and brown. I mean, for me, I think even chicken, right? When you cook chicken over fire, it just like chicken's great anyway. Obviously a lot of people love chicken, but I think chicken cooked over fire, like it's just a game changer. It's so nice. And that skin, the way the skin crisps up, and
there's something special about cooking it in a kettle style barbecue because it's such an intense and dry heat that it really does help that skin crisp up. It really does make a difference. There's something about, we all love a roasted chicken in an oven, but it doesn't eradicate the moisture. Like, so you get that lovely, you can get that lovely roasted colour, but it still goes quite soft quite quickly, quite afterwards. But a dry heat of a barbecue on a roasted chicken is just beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And also I think when, because I always start it indirectly, kind of away from the fire, and then at various points I'll put it directly over just to kind of get that skin going. And then I think the interaction that is caused by the fat or the juices dripping onto the coals and sending that kind of smoke back up, and it's quite subtle, but I did rotisserie chicken once and it almost tasted like I'd use wood, like it tasted like it had a wood smoke on it, but that was actually just the juices kind of
dropping
sort of
down,
dropping
the
down
smoke,
and sending it back up,
licking up of flames and the smoke coming. Yeah, that's what. So would you say, for people that are a little bit nervous that haven't entered into their barbecue journey just yet and they constantly think about it and talk about it, I mean, I think since lockdown there were a lot of people cooking at home and more people have got into outdoor cookery and the understanding of barbecue, and it's one of those biggest growing kind of areas of cookery, I think, because people love it. People love spending time in their garden. But if they're a little nervous of cooking things or not quite sure what to do, because, you know, they just assume it's for cooking burgers and sausages and that's it, what would you say would be a really good tip for beginners going out into their garden for the first time this spring?
Okay, so I'm planning on doing kind of a bit of a video series, because I know from what people say to me that they are still quite nervous about fire cooking, as you say. And so I ask people, like, what are their main sort of points that cause nervousness? And one of them, people said it's a bit of a hassle having to clean it, like bring the grates in and it makes a mess of the kitchen. I never, my grill never sees water, like, you know, like barbecues get moldy sometimes, especially if they've been sitting kind of under a cover and any residual food or moisture has caused it to get like a bit gross or something. The best thing to clean your barbecue with is fire. So just get loads of coal in there, light a fire, the vents open, get it really, really hot, and then get a brush and then just like scrub it and maybe give it like a wipe down. But it doesn't need to come in the house. Like, you can do that outside.
So a hot burnout kind of thing. And then a wire brush, give it a good scrub whilst you're doing it. And probably invest in a pair of those kind of like fire resistant or heat resistant gloves that you can give it a good scrub whilst it's going.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think in terms of outlay, like, you don't need, you can buy, you know, you can spend thousands on barbecue and equipment. I think for me, the only things that you need are, I think a pair of gloves are really helpful, and a meat probe, a thermometer to be able to tell the temperature, because, you know, people say about steak and stuff like that, and I can't do that. I can't, you know, but people say like your thumb, the sort of the...
That touch thing where people put it on your, between your finger and your thumb, if you hold it between your forefinger and your index finger and then you move down.
Yes. And you can probably, like, Tom...
That's rubbish. I'm agreeing with you. That is a load of rubbish, because each piece of meat is different.
Yeah.
Like human beings, our muscle structures are different.
Yes.
You know, so the same as whether it's you could have sirloin steaks and they're completely different. So the way that it feels is all about either experience or a temperature.
Yes. Yeah. And I think when you have a temperature probe, then that creates experience because it's like, okay, the meat feels like this and I know that it's at the right internal temperature. Okay. And so over time you get a bit more confident. And I think zoning your barbecue is really important. So I would say to people, do some chicken on the barbecue. Don't start it in the oven and just finish it on the grill, do the whole thing. So you want to have set up your coals. So you put the coals on one side and then you have one side that haven't got any coals. And that is the perfect way to start it. So, and you can see the side, view the side with coals as your hob and then the side without coals as your oven. And so when you want to get a proper sear on something, it's going directly over the coals. And then when you want it to be a more gentle heat, get it away from that. And then use your vents as well, because obviously fire needs oxygen, fuel and heat, right, to burn.
To keep it going.
And on the barbecue, the best thing, the easiest one to adjust is the airflow. So when you want to bring the temperature down, you close the vents a little bit. And people get nervous about flare-ups if the fire goes. And if that happens, just close the vents completely and put the lid down. And then, you know, 30 seconds later, that fire's out. And then you can just, and flare-ups happen all the time. And it's just fat dripping, like, especially if you're cooking something like pork, right? And it's really fatty. And if it's happening all the time, then just move the pork away from the direct heat, put it on the other side. It's still going to keep cooking. It's still going to be getting all that lovely flavour. And I think I have been cooking over a fire for a long time, and I can't remember a time where I've cooked something and it's gone so catastrophically wrong that it's been inedible. You might have to repurpose it, right? I mean, I've gone to cook some short rib and it went in too high and it just wasn't smoked. It was just kind of, and so I kind of cut it up and I put it into a stew. And,
it's got a bit of a flavour profile on it. And see, that's the one thing that I love about outdoor cookery and barbecue style food, where you've got smoke and you've got flames and you've got either direct heat into the coal and you can do slow cooking or something that's done quite quick, is that because those flavour profiles that you're getting are really quite intense and they're very, very different to cooking in a domestic space or even a commercial kitchen, you know, which is always very controlled. The way that you control barbecue cookery, it is a lot more free. It is all about moving things closer or further away, or trying to control the heat by shutting air vents down. Okay, but that's not the same as just turning the oven down inside, you know, 185 degrees or 210 degrees, or, you know, it is about so much more in touch with, I suppose, human nature and mother nature combined to create cookery. But what that does give you is flavour profiles that are, I think, much more forgiving, because everything just tastes great. So it's not about it being perfectly cooked. None of it is about pinpoint accuracy. It's a lot of it is all about what does it taste like. And that's the most important thing, I think, when it comes to outdoor style cookery, because the dishes that you put down in front of people, the food, they're always platters of food that are really, really tasty. And you can also travel the world with kind of your garnishes and your salads that you do. And no one thinks twice about, I don't know, some kind of like kimchi kind of like inspired salad followed by some, I don't know, Indian spiced lamb with some, I don't know, Jamaican jerk style pork. And then, and all those flavours. You just sit there, it's outside. It's, everything kind of goes together. Everything about it is much more forgiving, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so true. And I think... I think what you've just described, right? Like, I want to sit down and eat that. That sounds amazing. And I think, I think as well, when it comes to the sides, I think that they're really important. And I think, because so many people think about barbecue and they think about meat automatically. But I think if you've got sides, whether or not they're cooked on the barbecue, I think it just really kind of elevates the whole experience. And it kind of, I don't know, like if you've got a really nice herby green sauce to like drizzle over everything, I've got like my go-to, which is really easy. It's just whatever green herbs I've got, and then tomato shallots and some lemon zest and then vinegar and oil, equal amounts of vinegar or lemon juice and oil. And it goes over everything, and I can make it really quickly. A nice bit of coleslaw, you know, that kimchi-inspired salad that you're talking about. Give that to me.
Love that style of recipe there. You went, whatever green herbs I've got. I mean, that's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
It could be. It doesn't matter what it is. I'm just going to grab it and go for it. But where did you get this in kind of vibe and feeling for cookery? Who taught you to cook? Did you learn a lot as a child? What was your family kind of childhood background like? And how relatable is what you do now to those childhood memories of cookery?
Completely. Because so my dad's Jamaican, my mum's Maltese, and my dad was in the Navy, so he kind of travelled a lot. We didn't move around that much. We had a couple of years in Hong Kong when I was younger, so a lot of the food that I ate growing up was sort of Cantonese. And my dad's like a raw magpie. When we go to I don't know, like he'll go somewhere and he'll be like, right, this is amazing. And he'll suss out how to make it. Like Hoppers, we both know Karen.
Yeah.
And their bone marrow varaval. I took him to Hoppers and he was eating it. And he was like, I'm going to try and recreate this. And he pretty much got a bang on. He went home and just kind of recreated this bone marrow dish. It was, it's amazing. And so I think my dad's probably more of a prescriptive cook. Like he likes to, like his mise en place is incredible. No professional
mise
training.
Mise en place, you mean his prep? Like is it everything that's chopped and ready to go? Everything gets all of his work done before he creates.
Yeah, and I don't normally use sort of the French terminology, right, in food. Yeah. But he's so precise that it kind of, that is exactly what it is. And he just gets everything really ready. Especially I think because of the Cantonese, kind of like how much he cooks Cantonese food, a lot of it is about the preparation, right? And then you've got to be quick with the ingredients and get them in.
Yeah.
And you can't, like, if you're cooking with a wok, you can't kind of spend time chopping something up because everything will burn. And he didn't really let me join in that much. And I'm the same with my daughter, because I observed a lot and I fell in love with the processes and the alchemy, right, of how you can take one thing and just turn it into this thing that's kind of quite far removed from what you started out with, but is just like so much greater than the sum of its parts. And so that massively, and also eating a lot of different things as a kid, kind of my parents, they have these stories about how my brother and I, because I mean, we were quite cute kids. So we'd go out in Hong Kong and we'd go to a restaurant and then we'd go missing. And then we'd come back to the table, like holding like crab claws and stuff, because the staff have sorted us out, because we were just like well into our food and things like that. And so that really informed my approach. And I think it's this idea of food as a love language, and like going to my grandma's house and her having the curry chicken ready for us, like Jamaican curry chicken, and like the house would smell of it. And it was like quite a long journey to get there. And so that was really special.
That eclectic mix of food and food love and culture comes from your background, from watching your dad prep everything and put it all together. And I suppose then from that, what would you say is your favourite dish? Describe it to us.
Gosh.
Like, imagine, like, I have no idea what I'm doing at all. Describe your favourite dish and why we should be loving it.
Okay, all right. Okay, so I mean, obviously it's quite hard, but say today I'll say oxtail, right?
Okay.
So kind of Jamaican oxtail, and it's, oxtail's tough and everything, and it's kind of very bony, but cooked right, it's just delicious, and it's gelatinous, and the way the meat kind of falls apart. I don't like my meat too soft, but kind of when it just yields and it just comes off.
Yeah.
And you have like the cartilage and kind of the way that becomes like after a slow cook, like real gelatinous and just it. Because I think so much about food is like the enjoyment of food is texture, right? And for me, oxtail, the texture of it is just really pleasing. And you know that a lot of love's gone into it. And also, if it's not cooked for long enough, it's just terrible. And so with oxtail, you get your oxtail, which is now annoyingly expensive, and and you want to you can buy browning in a bottle, but with a lot of Jamaican like brown stew dishes, you make your own browning. So you basically put sugar in a pot with nothing else, and you burn it, and it's quite a test of kind of like your like nerve, because in any other setting you'd be like, oh, you burnt the sugar, it's gone wrong, but then you have this kind of like. It goes intensely caramel, almost black, like really, really like glossy dark brown. And then you get your oxtail, which is going to be seasoned in like onion powder, garlic powder. You want thyme in there, spring onion, like actual onions as well. Your scotch bonnet, like all different, like smoked paprika. You can buy powder blends, but I like to just kind of do it all myself.
Yeah.
Forgot to say pimento, so allspice, right?
Right,
so
yeah.
A lot of Jamaican dishes have allspice. So allspice is non-negotiable. And then you brown it in the browning. And then you
add all of that to the caramel.
So you add all of that to the oxtail. So like, you want to season the oxtail in kind of the dry spices, and then you get it into the browning and you mix it in, and then you...
Whilst that browning is still really hot and caramel.
Yes.
So you throw it into a hot caramel.
I add a tiny bit of water just to kind of temper it a little bit, because I kind of get a bit scared that it's going to go too far.
Yeah.
And then obviously that water evaporates pretty quickly, but then by then the oxtail's coated, and you just... after you've cooked it a couple of times, you know it's right because it's just like deep, like dark brown, and kind of the oxtail is just looking good. And then you kind of mix it up, and then you want to go in with water, a bit of tomato paste, a bit of soy sauce, a bit of salt. I'll probably leave the salt till the end so I can just test for seasoning, but you want the soy sauce in there, dark soy sauce, water, get the lid on, and then leave it for about like 4 to 5 hours. Classic Jamaican saying, like, it's ready when it's ready. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
like, but that's kinda... like all cooking. For yeah, me, true. Like, we get asked like so many times, don't we? How do you know when it's done? Well, it's done when it's done.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Like, you can put... Cookery and timings are there. They're guidelines, aren't they? Because everything, again, is slightly different. One oxtail may take longer to cook than another.
Yes, absolutely.
That's it.
And the temperature's never going to be exactly the same, like, no. all this sort of stuff. And then when you open it, and then when the oxtail is kind of like coming away from the bone, there'll be some bones in there that are kind of stripped of meat, like the meat's kind of gone into that sauce. Get in there with butter beans, and some people add carrots. Sometimes I add carrots, sometimes I don't. And also peppers as well, like sort of red and yellow peppers. Cook it for like another 20 minutes, and then it's good to go. And I like to have it with plain white rice, not rice and peas, and it's just delicious.
I mean, it just sounds so lovely. That's quite a new thing for me to learn there about you actually taking that caramel really, really dark and then throwing the meat in and cooking it into that. So we're talking about these cooking things that are going on there. Now, you were talking there about making the browning and taking it to a caramel. Now, that's but beyond caramel, that to me sounds like it could potentially be a big cooking disaster. What would you say is your biggest cooking disaster that you've had?
I think probably the worst one. I've had lots of minor ones, but I think most of the time they've been retrievable and it's been okay, even if I had to completely... change like what I set out to do, but obviously I would pretend that I was intending to do that all along.
That's how we all work, mate. Yeah, that's how we...
when I used to be a journalist, and I left that to, I was doing a supper club on the side, and then eventually I left journalism to all my journalism job to go like full time with food. And I had a pop-up in my local cafe. That was a cafe during the day, and then at night they were doing kind of pop-ups. And I was all like, I was so prepared and I was so ready. And they had induction pans and induction hobs.
Units, hobs, yeah.
And I was using their pans. No, I was using my pans. I brought my special induction pan, my special. It was for dumplings, for gyoza, and I bought my special gyoza pan. And I was already, first order comes through for gyoza, and I get the pan on, put the gyoza in, and nothing happens. And I was like, what's going on? And it just wouldn't work. And I was like, is it broken? And obviously my pans weren't induction friendly pans.
Because induction, they need to be magnetic, because it works off that. So if you had a pan that doesn't react.
Yeah, because I used
gas. You sat there going in a cold pan.
Yeah, and it was just there. And I was like, oh God. And so they had some pans that I could use, but they were... like they weren't kind of non-stick pans, and there were these massive pots, because it was for someone else. There was someone else's pots, and he did like sort of laksa and sort of big like braising pots. And I put the gyoza in, and then they just all stuck to the bottom. I was trying to scrape them off, and it was just an absolute mashup. It was awful, because I was. It was like the first one I did.
Welcome to the restaurant world.
Yes, yeah. Was yes. It?
At that point, you thought maybe journalism is for me.
Can I get my job back, please?
And what about guilty pleasures? What about things that you might eat or taste or absolutely love, but you don't normally confess to eating?
It's not so much a guilty pleasure, although I only ever do it alone, and I wouldn't want anyone to see me doing it. When I make, so with the oxtail, because I'm kind of the only person in my family who likes oxtail, like my partner and my daughter, they're not that keen. And so I make these oxtail nuggets where I kind of strip the oxtail off the thing, and I shred it, and I put it into a flat pan, and I refrigerate it, and then it kind of sets really hard, and like cut it into cubes, breadcrumb it, fry it, and then they'll eat those, right? Because they're basically like
a little bit
oxtail
like
nuggets.
An oxtail version of a rocky road, yeah.
Oh yeah, it looks like a brownie at that stage. But then when you kind of, it's like these like lovely like croquettes kind of thing, they're delicious, and so that they've kind of like, if I'm doing a big dinner for a lot of people, so like the other day I did the nuggets for one of the courses of a big dinner for like 80 people. And when I shred all that meat off, I'm left with like the bones that have got, it's the in between the bones, you have that like layer of like the little cartilage cap.
Yeah,
And it kind of, it doesn't come off, you can scrape it off. So what I'll do, I'll take all the meat and I'll just sit there in front of the telly, sucking all the bones until they're completely dry and scraping that little cartilage off with my teeth. And it's... It's so comforting, but I wouldn't want anyone to watch me do it because
I don't think there'll be a queue of people wanting to get that's something that I fancy. You like the cartilage bit off the oxtail?
Yeah, like, do you know what I mean? Like in between the bones?
I do know that bit,
And when it's cooked long enough, it kind of, you can scrape it off and I find it so pleasing. It's so nice. Are you not a fan?
No, I got to be honest, there's a guilty pleasure. You should feel guilty about that one, mate. Like, right, I've got some quick fire questions for you.
Okay.
Best ingredient to barbecue?
Best cabbage.
Really? Yeah. I love a bit of cabbage. What is it, the cabbage profile that you like putting on a barbecue?
So when it's, it kind of be any cabbage. Like people talk about like sweetheart cabbage or hispy cabbage, but it can be kind of like, you know, like I think Savoy cabbage is nice and you want to cut it through the root so it kind of stays together. It will just make life easier when it comes to doing it.
Yeah.
I rinse it and then I don't shake all the water off so that the steam in between the layers kind of helps it cook like from inside. And then I'll make some sort of butter, like a flavoured butter, and I will brush it as it's cooking. And then the edges get like brown and crispy.
I think anything with bar marks and smoke and heat flavor from coal is just magic. What did you have for dinner last night?
Oh, right. So I had a roast. It was Sunday, so I had some friends round and I made a roast with a like lemon and thyme and garlic butter and put that under the skin.
Roast chicken.
And that's like my go-to for if I'm doing butter under the skin.
It's delicious, mate. Favourite sandwich filling?
Do you know what? I don't want to get cancelled for this, but I've got like a bit of a soft spot for a tuna melt, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. I mean, I get it. It's not my thing. It wouldn't be my go-to, but that sounds...
I came to it really late in life because like my parents would never have done it. And I was always like, what, tuna and cheese? Like hot? Are you mad?
Yeah, what's wrong with you?
Yeah. Like, I wouldn't want to eat that. And I don't know how I came to eat it the first time around, but I was like, oh no, I get that.
Best kitchen tip you've ever been given?
So if I'm cooking down, this isn't one I've been given actually, but this is what I start to do. But if I'm cooking, we were talking about onion, like slow cooking onions.
Yeah.
And if I'm cooking like, so if I'm making a ragu, I like to put loads of vegetables in it so that like for my kid, right? Because I'm trying to like disguise them a little bit.
We're all there.
Do you know what I mean?
How old's your daughter?
She's six.
Yeah.
Old is your son?
Eight. Same thing. Okay. Yeah. Hide the veg.
Yeah. No, there's no veg in there. What are you talking about? And if I've got, so I like to make a lot so I can put it in the freezer. So I have like all my celery and my carrots and my onions. And I will add loads of water to that to help kind of break it down a bit. And so then I'll cut the water off and then it starts to caramelize. And it just speeds that whole process up to kind of, get the vegetables going. So
nice. Good kitchen tip. What do you listen to when cooking?
So I've got this playlist which goes from like, I don't know, like Tinchy Strider to Joan Armour Trading to, I don't know, Alicia Keys. But it's quite a terrible playlist. Like the people I've mentioned aren't that bad. They make me sound probably cooler than I am, but my music taste is pretty terrible. Or I love a podcast as well.
That's a good food podcast, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, are there any other podcasts?
No, I've never heard of them. What's your most trusted recipe?
My most trusted recipe is possibly my curry fried chicken recipe, which is like curry chicken and fried chicken. It's almost like done in a karage style, so like boneless chicken thighs, and it's got like a sort of a Jamaican like curry powder, which is kind of quite heavy on the turmeric, and then thyme and garlic and ginger, marinate it with a bit of coconut milk, and then coat it in like the mixture of flowers, fry it, and I serve it with like a lime mayo and then thinly sliced scotch bonnet that's also been fried and that's sprinkled on top. It's really easy, it's really quick, and it's delicious.
What's the most overrated food?
I think that there are these like foods, aren't there, that are kind of really like people go crazy for. Like caviar, like I'm not that bothered about caviar, you know, like just give me some salt, right? And like, I don't really get very much more from it.
Dehydrated feta, mate.
Oh my God, of course, yes.
Okay then, what's the most underrated food?
Oxtail.
Yeah. We've mentioned that a lot. I don't think it will be after that. No, everyone's listened to this. That's it. We also mentioned the price of oxtail gone bananas. Now is it like after you bigging it up so much now, that's it.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, but I was joking. Oxtail's terrible. Don't buy it. Don't buy it. Leave it.
What's the worst thing you've ever eaten?
Whale. So
where did you have that?
So in Weymouth. I come from Weymouth and I went back after uni and I had a friend who worked for like a sea governmental like sea. So they check like water quality. And so she would travel and then she would bring stuff back. Like she went to Australia and she brought back kangaroo and we ate kangaroo. That was delicious. And I'm sure we had some sort of like horse brazaula kind of thing, like type stuff. And that was delicious, like really red, but it was really delicious. And then she brought whale back. She went to Iceland and we had it raw and then we had it cooked. And however it was prepared, it was terrible. Like the metallic taste of it, like if I think about it too much, I can still taste it now. And it was just in my mouth for so long. And it was ridiculously unpleasant. Like it was something that tasted like you shouldn't be eating this. Like this isn't good for you. It was disgusting. What's the worst thing you've ever eaten?
Worst thing I ever eaten was a burger in Portugal at a water park. And it was singularly the most horrific thing I've ever eaten. Like of all the bizarre stuff that I've ever eaten and tried, and this burger was so bad. The level, the quality of the meat, God. Straight away. I could just tell this was just, it was so bad. It's the worst thing. Like it would stick with me forever. That was it.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm not going to say which water park it was. The slides were still good. And what's the ultimate comfort food?
Probably fried chicken. Like I've got a massive soft spot for fried chicken. And it's just, like I remember when I was younger, we could only have fried chicken. Like there was nowhere that did fried chicken in Weymouth. So if we ever left Weymouth, then it would be a treat. Yeah. And I remember thinking like, when I'm older, I'm going to eat chicken, like fried chicken all the time. And then I moved to London and obviously we've got like a lot of fried chicken shops. And I'm like, but I can't eat it as much as I would like. But like really good fried chicken, I think is just unbeatable.
Yeah, mega. And then what makes you now optimistic for the future?
I think just generally, like it really pleases me seeing connections being formed through food. And it's like that dish that you described of the kind of the, like, you know, inspiration from like Korea and India and Jamaica. And I think, you know, with people and food and like cookbooks, we're getting so many more cookbooks now from around the world. And I think it's the one thing that I hold on to that I think, you know, for all the division, like food has always been a unifier. We all have to eat and get someone around a table. It's very hard. Like if you share a meal with someone, it's very hard to walk away from them thinking, you know, I don't like you. And I think as I see more connections being made of different cuisines and different people and people learning about cuisines and learning how special cuisines are, like, you know, the people getting like sort of Nigerian restaurants getting first like first black chef, like Joke getting a first black female chef in the UK, getting a Michelin star in the UK. And it just gives me kind of, there is some hope and there's recognition. I think with that comes cohesion and celebration, and without like ending on too much of a cheesy note, like love, right?
Yeah.
It's just nice.
It's not cheesy at all, mate. I think that's a great thing. I think the British food scene in particular is one of the most diverse and eclectic and wonderful places to be, where because we're quite magpie-ish in this country and we'll take, and because our cultural backgrounds now are so diverse and different, and people, that lovely melange of people being together, that food is the one thing that combines so many different things. We all eat out in different restaurants, and it is such a wonderful kind of rich, diverse, forward-thinking kind of world that we live in when it comes to food. And yeah, your magic. What a great thing to be optimistic about. Melissa, thanks ever so much for joining us on this Good Food podcast. And we will look forward to dehydrating and seeing what you dehydrate next.
Yeah, so be careful. I'm looking at people next. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Good Food podcast. Tune in next week when Malika Basu will be joined by Angela Clutton to talk all about seasonal ingredients.